Hello, you're very welcome to my new podcast, Pricey Talks Real Life. My name is John Price, and I'm known to a lot of people as Pricey. For some time, I've wanted to host my own podcast, and I'm delighted that you're listening today. This is my first podcast, and our first episode will be on today. Over the next few weeks, we're going to interview many people, and the theme of the podcast is real life stories. We're not holding back. You know, we've got personal stories about struggles, achievements, happiness, positivity, inspiration. And some of the stories that you're going to listen to are quite compelling. I'm going to start today with our first episode, which we're titling Natural Born Addict and Surviving 9/11. And it's a chat with Brian Kerrigan. Brian is an Irishman from Dublin who now lives in New York, and he has an absolutely fascinating story. When we started chatting, you know, this podcast was supposed to be between 45 minutes and an hour on this story, but his story was so fascinating, it goes beyond that. And I hope you can have the patience and time to listen to this story because it's compelling. Brian, just to synopsisize on what this is about so you'll get an idea before you listen to it, Brian struggled with addiction from an early age. So he talks about that. And he talks about his young life in Ireland and talks about travelling to London, moving on to Australia and life and the struggles and the challenges that he had to overcome in those areas and the highs and the lows. Also talks about America, where he actually lives today. Brian ended up being in the Twin Towers, in the first tower, when that plane struck that morning on 9/11. And he talks about what happened inside the tower and how he got out of the tower at 9/11. It's a compelling story. And I hope you can stick with it. I hope you enjoy it. And thank you for listening to my podcast, Pricey Talks Real Life. And if you do enjoy it, please subscribe. Brian Kerrigan. So I just want to welcome Brian Kerrigan. He's all the way from New York. Hello, Brian. How are you?
Good to be here, Pricey.
Great. It's great to see you. So I just want to declare at this stage that Brian Kerrigan, who we're interviewing today, he has a great life story, full, very eventful, a lot of challenges in his life. And I'm delighted to say that he's got right through them all and he's nearly done a 360 full circle. So we're going to talk about some of Brian's stories today. Brian, before we get into that, you're an Irishman living in New York. How's New York at the moment?
It's grand, Pricey. I mean, it's different. It's very different. I've been here since 94, so 26 years. It's mad because everybody is... Downtown Manhattan is dead. Midtown Manhattan is not dead, but past 6 or 7 o'clock, you wouldn't recognize the place. I go into Manhattan regularly. It's very different.
We're getting a lot of USA news over here in Europe and in Ireland at the moment. And obviously with the elections that went by there a couple of weeks ago. And it's amazing when we hear about the COVID figures, particularly in New York. Now, this is not a COVID podcast, but just to briefly go on it, like, I think I was reading there that there was 35,000 deaths in New York alone. It's been very heavy there.
So New York City here was 24,000. Maybe the state is probably, that's probably sounds about right for the state, 35,000. Yeah. So right now that New York here is 9 million people, let's say. I worked it out. It's 29,000 people per square mile in the 5 boroughs of New York City. 29,000 per square mile.
You've nothing better to do during lockdown. Yeah.
I have a lot of statistics.
Yeah.
But so 24,000 people died in that. About, I think it's 300 square miles.
Yeah.
There's just 10% of the entire population of the country.
Wow. And it's been hit bad at his. Yeah. But look, we won't. COVID is a separate topic altogether. We're here to talk about you, Brian, and your story. And I'm going to just declare to the listeners out there that I'm calling Brian, but I know Brian as Kegs because we became mates as teenagers back in Dublin. We're both from Dublin. And although I'm living in the Garden of Ireland in Wicklow now and Kegs is in New York in Brooklyn, we grew up together as teenagers and have had many stories before Kegs headed off on his journeys to London and to Australia and eventually ended up in the US of A. So If I just talk to you a little bit about Dublin, what your memories are, your teenage years when you were 15, 16 years of age, what are your memories, Brian, at this stage, Kegs?
So, I mean, whenever I think back to home, and for me, 15 to 19, it's never really a pretty picture. It ultimately, we had great crack, but at around 14, 15, you wouldn't know this because it's not things we talk about when we're 16, when we're that age. But I was mad, what people call OCD now. You know, there was so much happening externally to me, nothing to do with me, but just family-wise and all that stuff. And so it was...
Now, just to paint a picture, Sal, we are talking about the late 70s, early 80s here. So it was back some time, which were different times than they are now, of course.
Yeah, of course, yeah. We're talking... So when that would have been 81, 82. But up to that point, like, I went to a nice school, I played rugby, I had a nice life, nice home, you know, dad was a professional, you know, we had, you know, I'm the middle of five kids, you know, a comfortable suburban life. Yeah. And then at around 15, 16, that went all pear-shaped for us, and we lost literally everything.
But was that due to the recession?
No, that was actually due to alcoholism, my dad's alcoholism, his brother and their business going down the Swanee through mismanagement and all that stuff. And yeah,
I remember your dad and your uncle, and am I correct in saying they were identical twins?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I could never tell them apart.
Yeah, identical. Yeah.
You'd walk around one corner and see him, and you'd walk around the next corner and still see him. Yeah.
They used that to their advantage. Yeah. But to answer your question, childhood or growing up was idyllic. And then I got 16 and 17, it got very confusing. Great crack. Yeah. Loads of fun stories, all that stuff. But behind it, underneath, there was a I won't say a darker picture, but I needed to be out of the house as much as possible because I didn't like what was going on in the house.
I think at that stage, like, we had a large group of friends around at that stage, and I'm going to test you here. Can you remember some of their names?
Yeah, Tiny, Chippy, Mackie, Pricey, Lono, Kegs, Churchy, Ego, Matt Byrne, OD,
Farler,
Connor, you know. There's a few.
There's a few more. It was a large group.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were all, in fairness, a little bit wild at that stage. A little bit wild. But the one thing, we didn't talk about anything.
No.
It was nights out. It was great crack. Everything. But what you're talking about, your circumstances there, you don't talk about those.
No. You and I, funnily enough, did. I don't know if you remember that stuff. We did.
Yeah, yeah. We've had many chats. Yeah.
But even back then, I remember. I don't remember when it was, that New Year's Eve. But when your grandmother died, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or was it Sean? No, it was your grandmother, I think.
It was my grandmother, we'd just been to a mad party where he fell down the stairs and broke his jaw.
He didn't fall down the stairs, he jumped off the banister. He was trying to prove his mettle to some...
Trying to be diplomatic.
He cracked his jaw open.
That's right.
But you and I did. Because I actually remember that. I didn't talk to... We didn't... That wasn't the thing. I don't even know if it's a thing now, like with your lads or Jack. Do they really have... I don't think boys at 18 are supposed to have, like, those deep conversations. But even back then, definitely we didn't. But I know you and I did.
Yeah, yeah. So... Memories of growing up in Dublin, if we just sort of go back to that. So your teenage years hanging out. So what were you doing then when you got outside the house?
Well, you know, getting drunk, getting high. I started gambling really bad, really, really bad gambling. I was breaking into homes and everything.
Really?
I mean, yeah.
and gambling, I do remember you used to go down to Rathmines to the slot machines and the poker machines.
Yeah.
And... You went to school at Rathmines, so you weren't too far from it as well. Yeah. So I presume you're talking about that area where you were doing most of your gambling.
There and in town, on Westmoreland Street. There was a place on Westmoreland Street, the Arch. I don't know if it's still there.
Yeah, it was there. So I think it's gone now.
Even when I go home now, and I don't know if it's still there, as I say, but when I walk past there, it still gives me the... Because that did me in.
Can I ask you on these kegs, how bad was it then at that age? Because we knew that you went to the poker machines. Yeah. And a couple of others went as well and would spend 20 quid if they had it, or 15 quid. Yeah. How bad was the gambling at that age?
Enough to put me into Pat at 19.
Really?
Yeah.
At 19?
At 19.
Well, so you finished your Leaving Cert in 84.
So I finished the Leaving Cert in 84. Everybody, well, not everybody, but Mackie and Chippy went to college. Yeah. That wasn't for me. I did nothing for about a year and a half, except at that point, now I was drinking at home probably every day or going out at night. I was stealing. I had no money, but I was stealing. I was breaking into homes. I mean, I don't mind saying it. It's just the truth. And I felt like my life was spinning out of control, but yet, I couldn't really say it to anybody. There's no one really to talk to. You know how it was back then. And then the gambling, when we lost everything, all the money we had. My mother opened a tuck shop, tuck shop in my sister's, school. So she would make a pittance, right, sell a Mars bar and make 10 pence on the Mars bar. And she'd have all these bank bags of 50 pence pieces in the back of the car to go down to make the deposit in the bank, in the shopping centre. And I'd help her. And I was stealing money out of the back of her car.
Yeah.
And that's what it was doing to me. So what that does, it ruins you, right, from the inside. So then I just said, to be honest with you, Pricey, I said, F it. You know, I'm just going to wind up like the old man, you know, like that sort of life. The name wasn't exactly great at the time. You know, my name's the same as Dad's. And I just said, fuck it. Excuse my French. There's no point to this. So just took a few pills and came to, actually. You know, that wasn't the plan to come to. And I woke up in... In St. Pat's.
I do remember you telling me this story before, and I didn't put too much emphasis on it at the time, but that's quite a serious thing for a young man at 19.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And how long were you in St. Pat's for?
6 weeks.
And very few people knew that at the time, like your friends.
Yeah. Didn't say
a
word.
Very few people knew that.
Yeah. The only advantage I had was that it was January, when most people tried to stop drinking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? So. I thought you were on the drawing. Yeah, yeah.
Which I was.
Okay.
But,
so six weeks in St. Pat's. Did you feel, was that for the gambling, or was that just for a bit of a breakdown at the time, or was it just for gambling?
It's a good question. I think it was the booze. I knew probably a good year before that I was going nowhere. So it was just a giant effort. There's no point to this stuff.
Yeah.
I can't get out of it. There's nowhere to go. And it was the booze. It was the breaking into people's homes, neighbours, the risk you take with that. I never got caught, but I'm walking around someone's house. What am I doing? Like, Jesus, this isn't the plan. Stealing from my mother. I remember that like it was yesterday. And then and then using that to gamble. And every single time I gambled, I used to walk home from Westmoreland Street, right? I wouldn't walk the way the bus went because people on the bus might see me. And I thought everyone would go, or school friends, oh, there he is again, he blew it all again. So it's just, you know what it is, Pricey, it's a low self-esteem, you got nothing to live for.
And I'll have to say that you didn't portray that, and that's probably, a lot of people are like that have that, didn't, to be a friend of yours. I did know your backstory, and we all had some sort of backstory, well, not all, but there were some, I had a backstory myself, but I wasn't aware to this level. So that was quite serious at 19.
Yeah.
So where did that take you then from 19, from coming out of Pats?
So I came out of Pats, it was the middle of February. My, what's funny, it was in Pats at the time. My uncle.
What? I was going to touch it. I was going to thought it was me. Your uncle.
One of my uncles was in Pats, and I think another one at the time was in John of God's. Remember John of God's in Stillorgan?
I do. It's still
there. Yeah. So I come from a good line. So
was he in the same ward?
I don't think he was. No, he wasn't in the same ward.
Did he know you were there?
Price, I don't even remember. Here's a funny thing. I was watching, this is gas, right, from what you remember from childhood. I was watching a thing about a year ago on TV, and a guy goes like this. I think it was the Matt Damon movie with, can't remember what it's called, but Good Will Hunting. So the guy is going like this, he's hypnotizing him. And I'm looking at it, I was with my girlfriend at the time, and I'm looking at it going, jeez, to myself, that looks very familiar to me. Like, it's just something weird about it.
Yeah.
So I rang my mother the next, I waited a couple of days and I rang my mother and I says, was I ever hypnotized when I was a kid, like a young kid, you know? And she goes, there was silence.
Yeah.
And she goes, and I went, oh, fuck. Yeah, you don't remember that? And I went, no. Well, how old was I? Thinking she was going to say like seven or eight, or why did I do it? 19.
No, that was when you were in Pats.
In Pats.
Yeah.
Barely any recollection. I don't remember being given medication.
But you don't. You're hypnotized. You're not supposed to remember.
That's what she said. That's what she said, actually. But you think you might. Anyway, I'd started in college and I started there for a week, but there was a gambling place nearby. So that kind of took over. So the fella from who was the head of the class or something from or that I did remember from the college came in. And he must have had a friend in there. We were messed
everybody
up.
Everybody was in there. Yeah.
Everyone had a friend in Pat's. And he came in. And I remember seeing him. And I remember to myself going, that's it. I can never go back to college. Because he now knows. And he's going to tell someone.
Yeah. Okay. So you got out of Pat's.
Yeah.
And you would have been 19. So fairly shortly after that, did you take your first step out of Ireland, or did you stay in Ireland for a while?
No, that was, I think it was, when you say fairly shortly, it's funny because I think within a week I was gone. My mother, my mother had arranged a job with me, for me with, remember the Gresham Hotel, is it still there, the Gresham?
Yeah, the Gresham, yeah.
Well, they were owned by Ryan Hotel Group, and they had a, I think we knew, or my mother knew someone who was the marketing person in Ryan Hotels, and she must have called him. I don't remember the ins and outs of it. Basically, you have a job in London and you're going next week, whatever. Let's just summarize it like that. And the next thing I know, I was in London. So I think I went to London in March of whatever year that was. That would have been 85, I think.
85, yeah. So the move to London, like a lad from Dublin, growing up, obviously some issues there. You've just come out of St. Pat's.
Yeah.
And you're straight to London on your own.
Yeah.
You know? Where's this going to go, I wonder?
Yeah.
But first of all, what were your thoughts there? Where did you stay? You had a job. Where did you stay? How did you survive in the beginning?
Oh, that was probably, of all the places, I think that was, well, you know, you came over. That was probably a great lesson in life. But one I wouldn't put that on anyone. And I don't mean that out of self-pity.
Can you elaborate on that? Because obviously it was tough in the beginning.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, if you have a problem, let's just say we'll call it psychological, a growing up problem, which is what I had with all that stuff that I was doing. Well, all you're now doing is taking me, it's not, the problem isn't Ireland or Dublin or the environment. I'm the problem. So now you're just taking the problem out of an environment and putting the problem into another environment. So all of the same stuff started happening, I don't know how long, maybe a couple of months in. So there was a gambling place two doors up from the office I had in Fulham Broadway. I had the key to the petty cash, and I would take the petty cash. There's no one else taking the money. There's three women and me working in that place. So the same stuff started happening. For me, London was a great education. I got into trouble in London. I think you probably know that with some street stuff. Just every now and then I had a mouth on me. I didn't like to be told.
Probably a bit of alcohol on you at the time as well.
Yeah, probably. But not always. I had a beef with, like most of us, I had a beef with Britain anyway. I had a beef with
England. Well, I do remember, I had spent some time away in Holland. I similar story as some people that didn't go to college in Ireland in the 80s. I left Ireland, like a lot of people left for America, left for London. I ended up in Holland and Greece and places like that. And I remember one summer, we didn't have mobile phones then or the internet to contact each other, but somehow I contacted you and you're in Green. You were living in a house in
Golders Green.
I don't know how I found the house. You gave me an invitation to come over.
Yeah.
But I don't know how I found the house. But I got there one evening and I was on my way back from Holland to Dublin. And I remember meeting you and I thought you were in good shape because when I met you, you were wearing a suit, a tie. But I later found out, later that night you told me you had the suit on hire purchase.
Right.
that you're actually renting the suit that was on hire. You couldn't afford to buy a suit.
£2.50 a week. It cost me £75 from the Littlewoods catalogue.
Yeah.
£2
for the suit.
Yeah.
And I remember you ripped the arse out of that suit.
Yeah.
There was no arse in it. So you were pulling the jacket down over it.
Yeah.
I remember one morning, I was sleeping in your living room on the floor and I looked, I heard a banging noise outside the house. It was a, like a clap. And I looked out the window and the heel was gone off your shoe. You had one pair of shoes. Yeah. And you were trying to nail the heel back on your shoe.
That's right. Yeah. In the pissing rain.
In the pissing rain, yeah. And you went off to work.
Yeah.
I just went back to sleep. I think we had a mighty few days. I spent a bit of time with you in London there and we went out on the piss.
Yeah.
We ended up going to Leicester Square.
Yeah.
I think the biggest storm that
That's
hit
right.
London
That's
in
right.
10 years hit one night. And we were so wasted, we didn't remember it.
Yeah. I remember we came out of it. We were in a pub in Leicester Square. We'd met up with a couple of people. We were chatting with two young girls. I don't remember how the hell we met them, but I remember we came out and either they said or one of us said, "Oh, it must have rained," and apparently some massive storm happened. Yeah,
that's 80, right.
85, 86. It must have rained. We didn't.
That's
we
right.
had no idea. But that kind of sums up a lot what's going on with life.
But it shows as well, and I remember I had to get back to Dublin because my funds were low.
I'll never forget.
London's an expensive place, and you went down to Houston Station. I was going by the ferry from Holyhead. King's Cross. I was going from the train station to Holyhead, and you pleaded with me not to leave.
I know.
You said, "Don't go, Pricey. Yeah. Stay. Get a job. Stay." Yeah. And I said, "I fucking have a backpack, and a few quid in my pocket. I got to get back to Dublin, because I was." Back there, I had a few quid in the bank back there.
Yeah.
And there was no ATM cards then. It was, you had to go into the bank to get money. And you were in tears. You were begging me to stay in London. Yeah.
And that goes back to what I was saying to you before, how I did connect with you. And even before we both left the country, we would have these, not deep, deep conversations, but I wouldn't have said that. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have said that to other people. I don't know. There's a kinship. There's something, but... But I do. I remember that like it was yesterday, because not just the memory, the feeling. No, don't go. And it was like the old black and white movies. I'm holding a red rose on the platform as the train pulls out.
I'm sure the passengers had great fun listening to our conversation that day.
Two
I can't
Irish
say. Don't go. I can't. Yeah. I can't stay.
Yeah.
Well, that was good.
Please don't
go.
Yeah.
So listen, we'll move on a little bit from that. So you spent London. Obviously, you stayed how many years in London?
I think it was about close to two, maybe a bit more.
And did you find the addiction was still there all the time when you were in London?
Yeah,
all the time.
Yeah.
And was that just the gambling, or was it alcohol coming into it as well?
The booze was definitely taking over more. No real heavy drugs. No heavy drugs. Weed. Hash, whatever, but not huge amounts. Mostly booze. I remember I would get drunk almost every night. I would get drunk somehow.
Did you keep your job? Were you able to stay in a job all the time over there at Kegs?
No, they eventually, Ryan Hotels eventually fired me because of probably over the money, but I don't remember them saying it was over the money. Then I got a job in a tile shop. I don't know how I got a job in a tile shop, but and I remember, trying to figure out. That was August of some year. I don't remember. Maybe 86. So maybe it was a year and a half, Pricey, or maybe it was... I don't remember exactly, but...
Okay,
it was 2 years, and that's what it was. Two years and a few months is how long I was there,
And from the tile shop job, did you have plans to come back to Ireland or plans to move to Australia or move further afield?
Plans? Plans were like...
Get out of town plans.
Yeah. Plans were more like... Well, I mean, I remember I didn't really have a plan, but then that other thing happened in Dublin with the kidnapping.
And just for the listeners listening in, just to explain a bit about the kidnapping, who it actually was.
So it was Jennifer Guinness had been kidnapped, and she was kept at my uncle's house for I'm not sure how long, a few days. He was not part of the kidnapping. He definitely wasn't. But he was... Remember the tuning fork?
Yes.
He was... he was an alcoholic. It's a bit like... He was like my dad. and someone basically, his business, their business had gone bust 2 or 3 years before. People from up north had lost money, and he, my father and my uncle, owed a favor, if you like. So he didn't want to comply. This is what I'm aware of. He did not want to comply, and they put a gun in his stomach and said, "We're taking your house. So it's up to you." They didn't tell him why. And then he went back to the house, brought the one fellow with him, and then the two brothers came with Jennifer Guinness. Whatever, I don't know. A couple hours later, I suppose.
And you found out about this while you were in London.
Yeah.
So you obviously came back to Ireland then.
Yeah.
To your family.
Yeah.
And that was big news in Ireland at the time, 86, 87, around about that period.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Somewhere around about that period. Yeah, yeah. And when you came back, it obviously, your uncle wasn't involved. He was obviously involved with his name, but he wasn't involved in anything after that.
No.
And for yourself, when you went back to the family, is that what happened? Did you stay in Ireland then? Did you stay with the family?
Yeah, stayed there for... that's when I got a job in, at some point in 87, whenever that was, 86, 87, that's when I was back home because, I mean, that bothered me because we'd already had, I think you know this, we'd had a lot of death threats and stuff from when the business went down. Now, this on top of it, and I was, my older brother had gone, my sister had gone, my two younger sisters were at home, my old man was not well, and my mother was the only one at home. And we'd moved up to Calamber Park at that point, the house had been sold, and I was a mess as well, but I remember coming home thinking that, you know, I have to be at home, because I was worried about stuff happening, and plus there was nothing happening for me in London anyway, so, and I actually felt good, I felt great being back home, you know, it was nice to be back in familiar environment, and back home, and having, you know, meals cooked, and a bed.
Yeah. So when you were home then, and you were just about to say you got a job, so what job did you get when you were back in Dublin at that time?
I got into stockbroking.
Now, that is, how in the world from a tile shop do you go to a stockbroking firm? How did that happen? Now, I know we're talking about the 80s. Did you know somebody? Was somebody pulled strings for you? How did that happen?
No, but I'll tell you this. The guy, so I remember somehow, I don't remember how I got the interview, or maybe even I might have just applied from a job in the paper. It probably was. And I remember going into the interview, and it wasn't my first interview, and I'd had, any time I went for an interview, and you know, I was, at that point, Pricey, as you know, I was aggressive. I didn't care for people who said anything about my father, about my name, or my surname and stuff. And so I'd had a few interviews. I remember taking my brother with me on an interview going, if I don't come out in 10 minutes, actually he said to me, if you don't come out in 10 minutes, I'll come in. Because, you know, I mean, we had a bit of crack with it too. So I went for this interview. It's white collar. It's a stockbroking company. And the man whose name of the company, it's the biggest one, interviewed me. And he said to me, are you related to Brian Kerrigan? And I thought, oh, this is the usual thing. And I just remember sitting there, not defiantly like, fuck you. But I just went, well, yes, he's my father. And I think that's what got me the job.
What job did you get? You were in a stockbroking firm. What was the job you got?
I was clerical. There's various stages behind when the deal is done. Then you have the clerical, the paperwork. So if there's five stages of the paperwork, I was probably the one stage closest to the dealing. I was hoping to get into the trading. That was the goal. I just wanted the job, to be honest.
Yeah. So you started there.
Yeah.
That probably would have been 87, I'd imagine, around about this stage.
It was. I'm pretty sure it was August 87 because the crash happened in October. And I remember I was there for the crash, yeah.
You were there for the crash. Yeah. And then, so from there, how long did you stay in the stockbroking company?
3 or 4 years. I went to another stockbroking company in 91, I think.
In Dublin?
In Dublin, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're back in Dublin now, and did the pattern go back to the way it was before you left for London?
Yeah, but it was more manageable. It wasn't nearly as bad, actually. I don't think the gambling was nearly as bad. I think I was starting to... I mean, I had a job, I had a certain amount of income, I had probably a bit of self-esteem because I was working The drinking was, I think I was kind of normal actually at that point, to be honest. Like, as in...
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that brought you up. So you worked in two stockbroking firms in Dublin.
Yeah.
I have to say, I was away, I spent many years away, so I would have been away in America myself around that period.
That's right.
And would have come back at some stage in 1990, maybe, 89, 90, maybe came back to Ireland. Yeah. So we would have hooked up around about 1990, around about then, the World Cup, around about that, just before the World Cup period.
If I had to say, I'd say you were back in 89. That's my
probably, guess. Yeah. And I do remember that you were always... We used to meet in the pub. We used to have great crack.
Yeah.
I remember, because I didn't have a career then at that stage, because I'd been travelling for a good few years, and you were a stockbroker. And at that stage...
I was a stockbroker.
Well, you were to me, you were a stockbroker.
Yeah,
you worked for a financial services stockbroking company.
Yeah.
And things were going well for you, and for some of the other guys in the group as well who'd gone that way. Yeah. So,
Pricey, I remember you coming back from America, and you would tell me these stories about climbing poles up in Boston, I think it was, and you'd say, kegs, you have to listen to me. It's all about fiber optics.
That's right.
And I was sipping my pint, going, oh, is that right, Pricey? In my head, I'm thinking, ah, poor Pricey. He's talking about making the things that you use for the dispenser, for the alcohol. You know, the optic. That's I swear to God, that's what I thought you were talking about. Until then, you started talking about, I think maybe Verizon. No, 9X or something, I remember.
Yeah, just to diversify from your story just for a minute. I had spent 3 years in Holland, and I went to the States for a year. And an incredible time, and I got an incredible job as a telecoms technician. Whereas everybody, other Irish guy over there at that time was roofing or painting or on a construction site.
Yeah.
Somehow I met the right people and I got a job as a telecoms technician with a company van, and it was fantastic. And I learned, I eventually went into the telecoms industry and did quite well in it. But
you were in Boston?
I was in Boston. Yeah, I was in Boston. And I know you're in New York now, but we'll just... kick back to that. So I came back 89, I met you 89, 90, around about then. But I know soon after that you left for Australia for some reason.
You were the one who brought me to, you better remember, you and Karen brought me to the airport 92.
92,
June 25th, 1992.
But my question is, you've a really good job in Dublin, things are getting back to normal. Why did you have to go to Australia?
I didn't have a really good job. I was doing okay, but the old me had come back. I left one company and I went to another one. The first one allowed me to leave graciously. I won't really go into that. And then I went to the other company, and then the gambler came back. Now I had moved up a little bit in terms of I was now trading, and the gambler in me, it was just a different form of gambling. So I would buy and I was losing money, and I'd made up accounts that didn't exist. I made up names that didn't exist. Again, it's just the truth. And, you know, it shows you how good of a trader I was. I was losing money. And I don't remember how much it was. Not huge amounts, $5,000-$6,000 maybe. I mean, back then that was, you know, 50 times more than what I had. Didn't have any savings. But, and they found out, and they asked me politely. Well, they didn't ask me politely. They fired me.
Yeah.
So I think that was 91. No, that was about, halfway through 91. And then I spent about a year doing odd jobs. I worked with Eagle and the carpets. Just odd kind of job.
Rough time.
Yeah, rough time. But enough to make ends meet, still living at home. But then, you know, it's back to, I'd fallen back, you know, into the same old crap. You know, nothing had really changed. I had a pair of shoes that stayed on this time. You know,
Australia came into your head because, of course, we had some good friends in Australia. Yeah. And at that stage, one of our friends, Steinty, Jim Steins, some of the listeners may know, was a well-known figure at this stage in Australia. He'd emigrated in 85 to play Australian rules football with Melbourne. And in 91, he won the Brownlow medal, which is the fairest player in Australia voted by the players. And he was a big, big name over there at that stage.
Yeah, huge.
So you went over, did you stay with Jim, or did you have contact with Jim when you went over to Melbourne?
I still have the diary, actually. So you brought me out to the airport. I spent one night in London. I lost my passport and all that, visa and everything, in Gatwick Airport. Thankfully it was found. And then I had written in my book from, I think it must have been from Steins, who said, a fellow called Jimmy Owens is going to pick you up at Tullamarine Airport in Melbourne. And I had to, I suppose, leave a message or call someone and say, I'll be wearing a black and red, funny how you remember certain things,
yeah.
A black and red shirt, a pair of jeans and a pair of the thing that I thought were the coolest sort of camel boots, I think we called them or something, or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know what they were, but so then your man met me in the airport. So this is kind of funny, because this is basically sums up Australia for me. He picks me up in the airport. He's from Dublin. He says, we'll go down to Molly Bloom's in Melbourne, in Port Melbourne. We'll go have a few drinks, meet a few lads. It was a Sunday night. He drove one of those old big American cars or Australian car, like an Oldsmobile or something.
Yeah.
And we went in there. At some point, we left that place. I'm literally off a plane. We left that place, went into some kind of nightclub. I met a woman. He met a woman. And I woke up the next morning on a waterbed. No sign of Jimmy Owens. On a waterbed, I had his number. And because he had told me in the bar that there had been a competition to see who could get the monkey off his back, basically who could get laid first. And I wanted to be that. I wanted to beat the record. So that's why I ended up with this woman and woke up.
There you go. That was your first night in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And is that Jim Owens, the comedian?
No. No, that's funny you say that. No, Jimmy Owens was this fella's name. He was a good mate of Steins at the time. He was from Dublin. No, it's not the comedian. So that morning, I remember having his number, and he just said to me, get on a tram that says Flinders Street. There must be a tram, because Melbourne is all trams.
Yeah.
And I went, Flinders Street is like saying, I'll meet you at the terminus in Westmoreland Street or something, or Bessaris or whatever. And then he met me in there. So Steins, to answer your question, Steins was fantastic to me. Steins was very accomplished. He was well known. He was also well known, and he was a smart guy outside the business. He got me, gave me a job selling insurance, I think. Home insurance. I don't remember the ins and outs of it, but I screwed that up somehow. I just didn't want to do it. He hooked me up with some other fellow who was a landscaper, and I don't know anything about it. I'm useless at that. Didn't work. And I remember being a disappointment to Jim.
Yeah.
And and I didn't like that. But and then I had
And of course Jim would have been an outstanding character of the Melbourne community and the Australian community.
Yeah. And a very principled man anyway. Religious,
very principled. Yeah.
Didn't drink much, kind of almost innocent sort of man. He did everything. You know, and thankfully, the good thing about that, Pricey, is that many years later, he came to New York, and I had made my peace with Jim, because he had no beef with me. He had tried to help me, but I had let him down, and he stayed with me when he came here. We had a lovely time, 2 or 3 days he was in New York. It warms my heart thinking about that when he was here.
Yeah, and it's a pity, and of course for the listeners that may remember, Jim passed away at 45 years of age from melanoma.
Yeah.
Which is back now, probably 2012 or so.
I think it was 11, March of
2011. And he was the healthiest guy.
Yeah.
An athlete, trained every day, ate the right foods, did everything by the book.
Yeah.
And so you just don't know when you're, because he was an incredible character if you look back.
Yeah.
You know, to achieve what he achieved.
Yeah.
If you look at what he achieved, from coming from playing Gaelic football to Australian football, and not just that, he could have nearly been a politician over there at the end.
There's a bridge named after him.
Yeah.
In Melbourne, there's he started the Reach Foundation as well. You know, Reach for outreach for wayward teens.
Yeah.
I just thought of the irony about
that. Why are we both laughing here?
He was Jim was like, you know, at the time when I think back to me now, thinking to Jim 30 years ago almost, he was a man's man. He is a man's man. That's how I see a man should be. At the time, he was a stick in the mud. Jesus Christ, Jim, would you not lay off a little bit or come out and get drunk every now and then? Would you not just not be so focused on trying to make money, you know, and being a normal human being?
I do remember when another good friend of ours, Chippy, got married in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
And we all went over for that wedding. And it was a great wedding. Cleveland, Ohio. You know, it's the start of the Midwest, I think, is what they call it. You know, it's you're going out there. And Jim travelled. He was the best man from Australia, and very good at making speeches as well. Did a great speech. And I always remember the morning after the wedding, he knocked on my room and said, can I borrow your car? We'd rented a car to, he was going off to a Baptist church to experience a Christian Baptist singing church. And that's the type of things he did. Like, we were all just lying in bed and relaxing, getting ready for whatever the day was going to bring this day. He was up at the crack of dawn looking to experience a bit of the Midwest and all that. And that sort of summed him up, you know, that's the type of guy he was.
Great guy.
Really. So Australia, you're in Australia. Jim's looked after you. It hasn't worked out. Where do you go from there? What happens next, Brian?
I had a year-long visa, so I don't remember what I did for that year. Basically, not a lot, but not a lot of good anyway. But at some point, maybe 8 or 9 months into that, I wasn't a tradesman. I didn't know how to do roofing. I didn't know how to do landscaping. I wasn't a plumber. I wasn't trained that way, and I didn't have that brain. But I didn't know what to do, because any job I have, I'm going to have to pack it in 2 or 3 months when the visa expired anyway. So I started a window cleaning round. I mean, anybody can clean windows. And in Melbourne, most of the houses are single story, they're like bungalows, you know. So all I did was I bought a washer and a little extension thing, a washer and a scraper. And I set off knocking on doors. And I remember the first one. I wasn't really thinking too far ahead. The first place I went, I was banging on houses on the road I lived on. So maybe, I don't know, 3-4 houses up, whatever. I knock on the door and this old fella answered, and he says, I said, I'm here to clean the windows, kind of assuming that he would just say, oh, okay, fair enough. And he goes, where's Michael or whatever, some other fella's name. And I said, oh, shit, that means he already has a window cleaner. Well, Michael's not here this week, but I'm going to do it. And I did the job, and he gave me 20 Australian dollars. And I thought, I'm never going back to that house, because if Michael gets a hold of me. But I started window cleaning around.
So you did the how long did that last for the window cleaning round?
A few months, I think. Maybe.
And how did that finish up, or did you end up going into another job?
Yeah, so I did. I made up a leaflet, and I brought it to the best neighbourhoods in Melbourne with the biggest houses. And in other words, if someone says yes to the little drop-off flyer thing I had, that's a job worth $100, maybe more, $100 for one job and a house. So, nice neighbourhood. One of the leaflets I dropped into a house, a woman called me, and she left a message on the answer machine at home, and she says, I have no idea what that message just said, but I really like your flyer, and I'd like you to come around and clean my windows. Okay, fair enough. So I'll go around to clean the windows. I chat to her. I notice she's got an office at home. There's two other people working for her. And I don't know how the conversation started. And she said, she was a lovely woman. She was like a mother to me, actually, a little bit like a mother over there. And she said, okay, that's it. You're stopping cleaning windows and you're coming to work for me. And that was her.
And what's the job?
I don't think I even asked. So it was, she sold coupon books. So they had a local shop would offer a service or a discount coupon, let's say 10% off Johnny's carpets. So you get a load of those, you put it into a coupon book, and then you do telemarketing. You have people who call out to all the residents of that neighborhood, let's say it's 20,000 people, and they say, you know, Johnny's carpets, well, you'll get a 10% discount if you want to buy carpet, go to Johnny's. So you keep business local, sell a coupon book, and we would get the commission. So that's what it was.
Okay.
So there was I think they were in, there was Judy was her name, Jan was her business partner, and then one other woman who worked for them, and then me.
Okay.
So that I would go into shops, like hardwares and shops. And
did that go well for you?
It was fantastic. I mean, in no time, I was interviewing people, so they made me sales manager for Victoria, sales manager. It wasn't like there was nothing there. It was just, all right, we'll call you sales manager for Victoria. So the coupon things that she was doing, selling, was only to only to the Melbourne metropolitan area. When I came on, and this other lad that I, or woman that I hired, and with Judy, we just got bigger. And it spread out from Melbourne into all of Victoria. So we would open satellite offices just for as long as the telephone campaign needed to go on, maybe 3 weeks a month. And it was unbelievable. Next thing I know, I'm literally going all over Australia, Canberra, Sydney, Perth, whatever, and I'm going to hire people. I became the national sales manager. Then they made me the director of, I don't know what the hell it was. It was some...
Yeah, so things were picking up.
Oh, jeez, it was unbelievable. Hit the jackpot, exactly.
From cleaning windows to national marketing manager.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I worked very hard for them, and I really liked Judy. And I hadn't screwed things up yet. I loved it, but I was illegal. I became illegal. That's right, I must have got the job.
Did they know that? No, they didn't know that.
I remember we went to Tasmania.
Your one-year visa was up.
Yeah, one-year visa was up. I remember we went to Tasmania, Hobart. We flew from Melbourne down to Hobart. And we'd gone out on the piss. Now, that's not, you don't need passport control for that. So we'd gone out on the piss. And the next morning, we had to drive from Hobart to Launceston, which is right across Tasmania. It's probably only a 2 or 3 hour drive. So Jan, I had no driver's license, and I had to make up a story about why I had no license. I don't even think I knew. Oh, no, I didn't know how to drive. So then Jan said, I'm too hungover. I'd like you to drive. And I have no license. She said, it doesn't matter. You can drive the car. And I just thought, if we get stopped for any reason, not only... I'm booted. I'm out of the country because I was illegal.
And, sure, yeah.
Oh, it was it was very nerve-wracking.
So did you come clean? Did you let them know?
So long story short, they said to me, things had gone so well in Australia that they wanted to open up in America. They wanted to do this business in America, and they were seeing, you know, you could make a fortune on this because it was really successful in Australia. So they said to me, they took me out for lunch and they said, we have a big celebration. We want you to go to America to open the business and to run the business. And all I'm thinking of is, oh, shit. Because if I leave, I'm not coming back. I can't. Yeah. Oh, the one thing, sorry.
America, first of all, were they going to sort out a visa?
That's pure coincidence. Now, I'm not religious, but if I was religious, I'd say something was happening that I was completely unaware of. Because... you know, in the bigger scheme of things, my mother had cut out of the Irish Times or the Irish Independent or something the visa application for Donnelly visas. I think they were the Donnelly.
That's right.
Or Morrison.
The Donnelly and the Morrison visas. Yeah.
She had cut out one for me and one for David, my brother, and sent in the application. Like, you just put your name and address. I don't know. I got called in the lottery, and so did David.
So both of you got green cards.
Well, you get called in the lottery. Now you just have to pass all the tests, medical, security, and whatever. I think you had to have a job organized or something like that. So they must have known that. I don't remember. Jan and Judy must have known. Do you know what? I really don't remember, Pricey, but it makes sense that they would have known, because that might have then thought, okay, you can go to America and start the business in America. So I had the visa. So I went back from, I went into the police station in Melbourne to get a security clearance from them, knowing that your man was going to look at my visa and go, what, you're illegal. But at that point, I needed a safe passage letter or something from I forgot to tell you, because I took them out to lunch as well, Jan and Judy. Judy was the one who was like a mother to me. And I took them out and I said, I'll happily go to America. The problem is, I'll never be able to come back to Australia because I'm illegal here. And Jan, who was a big woman, I'll never forget, she banged down on the table like that, fuming, and left. And Judy just burst out crying because I had deceived them for however long, like a year or something like that. That's it. Yeah, but a little over a year.
Well, I suppose you had, but they had got rewards from that deception
They had. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They had, but they just felt it was a betrayal. But Jan got over pretty quickly because she knew the trade-off basically was that, okay, but I'm going to go to America and open the business over here for them.
Yeah.
But I felt bad about that. I did.
Did they agree to that, though?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah.
So they did.
As a matter of fact, Judy was very well connected somehow in Melbourne. The lawyer the company solicitor, his name was Sam Holt, H-O-L-T. He was a horrible, lovely man, but horrible alcoholic. He was the son of a former prime minister. So he was about as well connected as you could be. So they asked him to see what he could do to get me a visa or something for Australia to get past this illegal status that I had. And there was nothing he could do. I think I would have had to leave for 6 months and then come back. But it was never going to... But I could come to America. So I came home to Dublin from Melbourne. I remember, and I was home for 3 weeks. Well, I had to go to the US Embassy, and I had to do something else in Dublin to go through I had to be an interview, actually. So I came back to, and then the interview in the US Embassy in Dublin, which was just
Did everything go okay at the US Embassy? Yeah. At that stage, your green card was going through.
Yeah.
You had the job offer from the marketing company in Melbourne. To set up in what part of the States?
Phoenix,
Arizona.
Yeah.
That was on the map there recently with the Trump Biden. Arizona was a key state, wasn't it? One of those ones,
No, thank God I went the right way.
Yeah. So you traveled. Did you go on your own? Did you have any contacts over there when you got there? How did it work? That's really interesting. Tell me a little bit about it and tell everybody a little bit about that.
Yeah.
So. Maybe this is a part two series, but if it is, we're into part two. Go ahead.
So that was funny you remember dates. I remember like it was yesterday. It was 25th of September. And I remember going through, so I arrive in Phoenix and I had to hit the ground running because I was setting up a company. So I had to we had lawyers involved that we knew who they were. So I had to arrange meetings and rent a car. I was like the Irishman who comes to America, but I'm not on the street. I was staying in a Hilton hotel in Phoenix.
You know, company like credit card.
All on the card, but it's expenses. I was the man,
That's
what it felt like. Jesus, this is how you're supposed to arrive in America, But I'll tell you this, what I remember very clearly was the first time ever that I felt alone. And I never really truly felt that when I was in London because this was the first time, and it was the first time I really thought, I have to be very careful with the booze and the drugs at that point because I knew that this is a perfect environment for me. And I can't remember why I thought it, but I felt sort of, not lonely, but untethered somehow. Oh, God, there's no framework around me. I don't know anyone here.
Yeah, but America is a different kettle of fish. It's a different environment to go into. I suppose I can relate to that a little bit from being over there. It's a different, and you do have to be careful.
Yeah,
because you can get in a lot of trouble in the States.
Yeah, and I didn't know anyone. I don't think there's ever been a city. I mean, there'd be very few even back then. We all knew. I knew people in Boston, in New York, not many, but there's always someone whose brother is there, whose cousin. I give him a ring. There was nothing like that in Phoenix.
Yeah. So let's move on to the job then. Did you set up the business? Did it succeed? Like, what was the plan? How did it go?
Well, the plan was that Jan and Judy were supposed to come over at some point, maybe a month later or 2 months later. I don't remember the ins and outs. I was supposed to get a office space in Phoenix, meet the lawyer, incorporate the company. Probably a few other things, maybe get in touch with a printer. You needed to print things and all the basic stuff. And I think I was supposed to start selling as well. And I felt intimidated by the selling because I had just been the sales manager, but I'd never really gone door to door. Just briefly I had in Melbourne, but I didn't need to because I was able to hire some. I think I was a far better manager of salespeople at that point than actually being a salesman. I felt really intimidated.
Yeah.
But I remember being very intimidated. I had to make speeches to groups of business owners and stuff about this wonderful product we were going to bring over. And I did a bit of research over here and I went, there's nothing new about this whatsoever. It's like anything in America. It's probably come from America in the first place. Anyway, but I, honestly, Price, I was hitting the booze all the time.
Okay, night and day. You had the company incorporated, you had the premises, the business wasn't going too well. Never got to premises.
Never got to premises in Phoenix. We opened an office in a town called Bullhead City. I don't know why. I really don't know why. It wasn't my decision. But Bullhead City is a town about 4 hour drive from Phoenix. And it's right on the border of Arizona and Nevada. So the Colorado River separated Bullhead City, Arizona, from a town called Laughlin in Nevada, or Laughlin, that's how it looks like. And in Nevada, gambling was legal. So it had all the glitzy sort of, it was a small town, like a mini Vegas, but literally right across the river. I mean, I knew it.
The lights were flashing at you.
Yeah, they were calling me.
Did they call you?
Oh, yeah. They called me. Pricey, you know, this is the, and I think this is fantastic what you're doing, because you're talking to people about real life. We're not just having a bit of crack relating, you know, then I went here, then I went there. This is real life stuff. I arrived in America on September 25th. I remember Thanksgiving, which is funny because it's 26 years, almost exactly now. 94. And I remember I was going in the casinos now. You know, I'm supposed to be running a company or getting a company up and running. I'm in the casinos and I can still hear it, the sound. You know, ding, 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 ding. This isn't the Arch anymore. This is the big time, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget this woman dealing cards to me, blackjack, they call it, pontoon, or what, a 21. And just me and her. And she said to me that all these decorations of happy holidays, happy holidays. I'm going like, it's middle of Jesus November, like Christmas isn't for another 7 weeks or whatever, like that's what I was thinking, you know, like Americans. And she says to me, it's Thanksgiving. And she said, do you know what that is? And I went, I know it's a big American thing, but no, I really don't know what it is. And she said, and I'll never forget the look on her face, it was like, this fella's lost. And she felt sorry for me, that's, I swear to God. And it made me feel terrible that she took pity on me. And she didn't.
So you were starting to realize again the situation that you're in. Like,
oh, I was done.
You were 19, in Dublin.
Yeah. I still had money, but I knew it was only a matter of time. I couldn't stop.
Gambling. And you were gambling. Drinking.
I was drunk. I think I was drunk literally one end of the day to the other, but manageable, so not fall down drunk. I was also smoking weed. And then, but the gambling every night, it was, I swear to God.
And how did that cycle end? Because you've got these people in Australia you've got to report to. How did this end up?
It ended up badly. I was also, because I started the business here, I was the signatory on the bank account. Right? So any money that they had sent over to start the business was in there and I had access to it. So, but I'm feeding a gambling habit and I'm trying to, you know, dodge their phone calls. I don't remember the ins and outs of it. I'd rented a car. I was driving drunk all the time up in throughout northern Arizona. I mean, shit-faced. Like, bad. But I couldn't stop. I kept going back to the gambling. So I ended up, I drained the bank account, took everything.
Yeah.
I lost every single penny I had. However much money I'd come over to America with, I don't know what it was, 10, 15,000 Australian dollars maybe, American dollars. Blew it all gone, and I wound up homeless. I call it homeless. We had a temporary office that they had shut down. Jan and Judy came over. They knew there was a major problem over here. They came over. They shut everything down. I don't think I ever even saw them.
And, you were missing in action.
Oh, yeah. I remember standing on, that's how I remember the Colorado River. I wanted to just jump in the river.
Really?
Yeah. I was.
Teams got that low.
I never felt the same feeling I had, and it was gambling again. And I remember thinking, you're just one of those people, Brian, that life isn't good to. You know, like self-pity, whatever, but I had no way out. I had just no way out. No one to talk to, no one here. I'm completely on my own. I've literally lost. I've nothing.
And what?
And the car is gone there, you know.
So what pulled you back, and how did you get out of that situation?
So, again, it's funny when you look back. The office that we had, I sold the furniture we were going to have a small sales office. Maybe that's why we were up there, for easy access to the Nevada market. I really don't remember. But we had tables and chairs and a few desks and whatever. And I remember I sold them. Don't even know how I sold them, but I know I sold them to a man and his son, and they gave me $125 for the furniture that I had, which is probably worth $1,000. Jan and Judy were now gone. The bank account was closed. I had no credit cards. I had nothing. I had absolutely nothing. The only thing I had was the fact that the lease lasted another couple of weeks on the office. I was sleeping in the office and the phone was still on. I don't know how, but the phone was still on. And back then, there was no mobile phones and the phone was on. I called the world. Who do you know and where are they in America? My brother and David and Susan gave me the other half of the fare, one-way ticket, and eventually decided I was going to come to... It was either going to be Los Angeles or it was going to be New York, or it was going to be the Colorado River.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. It was horribly, horribly... I think I was probably closer to the top of myself.
Well, that sounds like a very difficult situation you were in there now.
Terrible. I wouldn't... Look, it's just the truth. You know, I didn't feel like I had a way out.
And so you had the fare to go to LA or to go to New York. Yeah. Did you have somewhere to go when you got there?
My brother, so I said I'll go to New York. There was something about the word Manhattan.
Yeah.
It's funny the way you pick things.
Yeah.
I says, no, I want to go to Manhattan. And so I came over here. I arrived here on Christmas Eve, 1994. And I was met in the airport by a friend of my brother's who was a mechanic over here. And he allowed me to stay in his house for about 3 weeks or 4 weeks or something like that. But in fairness, because I had all these names, this is gas, I had all these names on that piece of paper, right? And I had called them from Bullhead City. So now I'm in New York, I have a phone, and I remember calling people, and they worked in, some had great jobs, like finance jobs in Wall Street, and, you know, people with different jobs or whatever.
Sure.
I took a job with a Liffey moving company, a big moving company owned and run by, I think he was from Cork, in Harlem. I remember having to take the train in from New Jersey, where your man lived, Jimmy, go to 125th Street and 2nd Avenue or something at very early morning in January, thinking, that's it, I'm going to get, you know, Irishman disappears on the streets of Harlem, whatever. But I worked for Liffey Moving Company for three weeks or something. There was a lad there from Kerry. He said, I have a room in that we need a third roommate in the house in Queens that we have in Queens. Okay, right, I'll do that. So I moved to the house in Queens. Effed that up very quickly. Your man was from Tullamore, I remember, and he'd a huge stack of weed, and he was a chef. Mad old story, but he was a chef in Manhattan, and but I started stealing his weed,
and he obviously noticed.
I had no job, I had nothing. Liffey Movers was kind of, you know, you had to go on spec, maybe you get a job, but it was January, February, not many people were moving, and he found out about the weed. He didn't like me anyway, and now he had good reason, and he booted me out of the house. The girlfriend I had from Australia had now come over. She was on her way over. So I remember having to stay in a bed and breakfast in Williamsburg and Brooklyn for a few nights as well, like just while I tried to get digs. But anyway, to answer the questions you asked, I made all these phone calls. I had a meeting downtown Manhattan where I dressed up, I had, you know, this shirt and tie, and I tried to look like I was professional. And the fella that I was talking to, he was an Australian, right? So I had a connection. He was a friend of a friend. That's how I got the meeting with him. Never forget it. We're in this pub in somewhere between Christmas and New Year. That's how quickly. I mean, I didn't have time to waste.
Yeah.
So it was only within 3 or 4 days. And he said to me, and everybody's out on the piss, right? And they're all like, he's an Australian. And I'll never forget it. And he says to me, so that guy, they're all earning over $100,000 a year. And I'm looking at them. Half of them are, oh, mate, you know, I'm going like, if that fucking asshole can do it, I can do it. You know, the Aussie was very nice. And 3 months later, long, you know, interview here, interview there, you know, following up, I started working for them.
And this is, so your experience in Dublin in the stockbroking firm had come back to roost to get you this position. Is that the way this worked?
You know, I'd love to say it was. I really don't remember. I don't even think there was ever a CV shown. I think it was just the questions
back,
I was
you're
asked.
Back in the financial world now.
I'm back in the financial world, yeah. Can you talk? Yeah. The things that appealed to them to give me a job were, he's Irish, he can drink, he can smoke, or whatever. He smokes, he drinks, he seems like he's got half a personality, half a brain. Give him a job. You know, yeah. Those were the, you know, do you have stamina? Are you any good with numbers? Blah, 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 blah. Can you sell? Yeah. Okay, give us a job. 17 grand a year. $17,000, which was nothing.
Yeah.
Jesus, nothing. By the time after taxes, you got maybe 900 a month or something.
There's also a perception with it. Forget the salary for a minute, but anybody back at home that hears Keggs is working in Wall Street, he's in New York, the immediate impression is that this guy's doing very well for himself. That would be the immediate impression from the outside.
Yes, of course. Because all you do, you just say that. You say yeah. New York, you say Wall Street, you say whatever. Then, yeah, the assumption is that you're doing really well.
Where did this take you? Because I know there was some serious things that happened around 2001 that yeah. affected your life as well. So 1995 to 2001, I presume right. you were going up.
Yeah, things were grand. Things were great. It was like, you know, oh, okay, so I can, I can do what I wanted to do. I was good at what I did, entertaining clients, going out at night. I mean, it was, honestly, Pricey, it felt like, again, I've hit the jackpot here. Things were really good. But, you know, the constant was I was drunk every night.
Yeah, well, I do remember probably 96, 97. I was at a wedding in Boston with Karen. My wife Karen. Yeah. So we travelled about and we came down to Manhattan for a few days and I met you.
Yeah.
This is before you met your wife. I think you had an Australian girlfriend at the time.
That's right.
But you were working on Wall Street. I do remember that.
Yeah.
You were working on Wall Street because we went out one night to a bar and two of the guys that you work with came with you and they were probably a little bit more senior than you or yeah. that's the perception I got.
I don't remember but
it was like something out of a movie. The amount of shots that were going down. People have been putting headlocks. It was like the Wolf of Wall Street type of movie.
Yeah,
you know, that type of thing coming off that. And I was out of my head. You were out of your head. Everybody was out of their head. And I remember waking up the next morning going, wow. And you told me you did that every night, you know, or every day. That's what you did. I was going, wow.
Yeah.
That was part of your job.
Yeah.
Can I take you along then? So you were doing this for many years and it was perfect job, as you've just said, because you were able to drink, you were able to go out, you were able to work. So it was a combination of everything you were doing there. If we can jump ahead to maybe 2000, 2001,
yeah,
you know, where you were then and where you were working and 9/11,
yeah,
you know, around that period of time, like where were you just before that and when that happened, if you're comfortable talking about it?
Yeah, no, that's grand. In 2000, I went from one company working on Wall Street to another company. And that was in maybe, that was 99, maybe 98, 99. And that was in the South Tower of the Trade Center on the 55th floor, I think it was. I'm thinking 98, 99. So, I'm aware because, and a lot of the fellows I worked with had been there in 1991 for the first bombing. And they were, you know, on the odd occasion we would talk about it. And really, that was only 7, 8 years past. When you think we're almost 20 years since 9/11, it would have been very, not the same, obviously, what happened in 91, but they, or 93, whatever it was, they did remember it.
Yeah.
I loved it. Jesus Christ, you look at the buildings, they're 100 and something floors high and I'm working there now. And
you're on the 57th floor, great view of Manhattan, the whole lot, everything.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm not a braggart, you know, like I'm not one of those chest beating sort of people, but internally I loved it. I just thought, Jesus Christ, I'm working in the World Trade Center, I'm making a lot of money now, I have the woman, I got married in 2000. It just felt like, you know, life was going very well. But the truth is, I was drinking. It was the drink was a problem now because Medina, my wife, was telling me these things. She would say, like, you can't keep going like this. And other drugs, Bryce, the other drugs were really taking off. Cocaine was becoming a big feature. And I'm not, The Wolf of Wall Street is a funny movie, and it's terrible what he was doing, cheating people and stuff. I wasn't in the same business as him, but the life was very similar. It is chaotic. It really is chaotic, and it feeds a particular personality, which was mine.
Yeah.
But I didn't really like the huge groups of 20, 30 people and get all the strippers. That was never really my thing. I just loved to get out of my mind high.
Yeah. And at this stage, in the company you're in now, obviously you're on a higher salary and it was more entertainment. Yeah. And you could do other things and afford other things as well. And the lifestyle.
Absolutely. I had a great life and things were going pretty well. So I'm in the trade center, 98, 99, 2000, somewhere around there. We moved to the north tower on the 25th floor. I don't remember when, somewhere around, maybe it was 2000. You know the rest. In 2000, September 11, 2001, I go to work like any other day. And a plane hit the building, you know, so obviously I got out.
Just curious on that, was it the first plane? Were you in the tower? You were in the first. Did you hear it? Did you feel it? Did you know what was... You knew what was happening? You knew something had happened?
Yeah, you couldn't. I mean, I'm only on the 25th floor. And actually, I remember I had just done a relatively... I'd just done a deal, right? A trade. And I was leaning... At that point, we still had to write out the trade. Once you do the trade, you hand it over to someone else. And I was leaning back in my chair to give it to a guy, not the fella next to me, but the one after him. And he was leaning back and I was leaning back. And we still talk about it to this day. He's a friend of mine. And how we never made that exchange of the ticket. I was handing him the ticket. And he went to reach for it and I went to reach for it. And the next thing...
Bang.
Well, we moved probably...
Yeah.
I would say 2 feet. Most of the fellas I work with say it was a lot more than that. Maybe.
And what... I'm really interested in this now. So when this happened, what was the reaction to people around you on the 25th floor? Because this was above you. You knew there was something. Did you all just get up and start to evacuate, or did people...
Yeah, that's pretty much, you know, I have to say, this is the part for me, Pricey, where I've learned a lot about myself since then. And not just about drinking drugs and stuff, but I think this is a childhood thing. Maybe you'll know what I mean. You know, when you grow up in a house or in an environment that's very uncomfortable when you're a kid, you know, like when I was a young kid, it was never very violent. It really wasn't like that, but it was always extremely tense with dad's drinking and all that, just chaos. I've had this thing since I was very young. I don't remember how old, where, if I got into an altercation, in London, maybe it started, maybe I do a pat down, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm all right. Like, I haven't been stabbed. Yeah. I haven't been, not that I was, I wasn't, that's not my lifestyle, but still, there was where you just do this pat down. And I do an emotional pat down at times too, when something like that happens. I mean, obviously, things like that don't happen all the time, but boom, smack, something just massive has happened. It's boom. Okay, physically, I'm okay. If I'm physically okay, now I just have to take care of this. So for me, to answer your question, yes, there was a sense of people who got up. There was a sort of look around for a while going, okay, something really, really, really bad has happened. So there was panic. There was shock. I remember a lot of faces were just, and they just streamed out. There was no running. There was no screaming.
Just
they
walked out.
They just went out towards the lifts. I didn't. My first reaction was to do that little pat down, going, okay, something really bad has happened. Maybe it's happening as I'm speaking, or sorry, as I was thinking at that time. I did a little pat down, emotional one or mental one, and I walked over to one of the big pillars in the building, because I'm thinking that it's coming down. I'm literally thinking it's pancaking, and that it's you know, I'm going to die. So I need to be next to a pillar, because you know the way you see in the old, like, Second World War movies, the house has been bombed, but there's an old fella holding a baby, and he's on the little crack by the pillar. That's what my thought process was, just go by the pillar. I'm 25 floors up, I don't know what I'm going to do. But, you know, and I walked over to the pillar, and I remember I stood by the pillar like that, and I watched people walking out. I don't remember if they were going like, what the fuck's he doing? Excuse my French, but... And I'm just standing by the pillar, and obviously it didn't come down. So then I thought, oh, sorry, what I forgot to say was people did start to hurry it up, because I remember looking out the window. And sorry, that's why I was thinking it's coming down, because I saw all this debris falling down the side of the building. And even on the 25th floor, what had happened, I can't explain it. It wasn't like I knew it was a plane. Of course, I didn't know it was what it was. But something clearly had happened to knock the building from side to side. I mean, it's literally, if you stand still and you topple yourself over all the way over before you fall down and then bring yourself back, that's exactly what happened. Yeah. It's like, boom, what the hell? And then boom, it comes back, but then it's like little rock here and then steady. I mean, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying.
Oh, I can imagine.
You know, but you don't really get to, you don't really get time to. It's weird. So, you don't get time to be too terrified.
So, were you one of the last ones to leave your office to head out? Did you go down the fire escape or did you go down the lift?
So, I don't remember if it was one of the last ones. There were a few other. There was probably, I don't know. I mean, again, we're not talking.
Yeah.
You're just talking. Most people immediately left, and the ones who didn't leave immediately left within 2-3 minutes. So. No, I went straight to I don't remember anyone going in lifts. We were put onto the stairs. So not put onto the stairs, but going down the fire escape. I remember getting onto the fire escape and it was packed already. There's no panic though, but people from floors above. Yeah. So maybe it was a bit longer than 2 or 3 minutes. And it was packed. And I remember looking at it and just this one feeling in me, which was do not panic.
Yeah.
Not panic. Don't be the panicker. And I have to say, there was no panic on that, no overt panic from people on the stairs. There was a woman directly in front of me who, you'll get a kick out of this. She was, she was going to be what I thought a panicker. The thing I was most worried about was panic and being crushed because there's nowhere to go and being crushed. And I thought, if she panics, something's going to happen. So I helped her, but she doesn't know this. But I held her hand. She didn't speak English, but I held her hand, and she was like doing this. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, so if she gets worse, how do you knock someone out? Like, do you bang her on the back of the head? What do you do? Like, to stop her? I swear to God.
Okay.
Like, okay, so it's just very practical. But at the same time, holding her hand, going, it's okay. She was, I speak a bit of Spanish. I was talking to her. It's okay. But internally, I'm going like, just keep moving. We get down to about 10 or 12, somewhere around there, and it stopped. The procession, if you like, stopped. And I remember hearing the bang of metal on metal. And you know what it is. Like, it's probably the people trying to get in through the fire escape door. And you know what I remember thinking? Do you remember the Stardust?
I do, in Dublin, back in the 80s,
And I remember thinking that people died because they were unable to get out in that fire. And I remember thinking, Jesus, the same thing could happen here. Because the firemen are trying to get in, and they're metal on metal to try and break the door down, and we're going to get engulfed by fire, or we're going to get crushed. I wasn't thinking that the building would come down. And that's when, honestly, I was terrified, but Pricey, there's not many things that I would say that I feel. I think I was supposed to be there. And I'm not saying that out of it felt okay to me. It felt I wasn't, that I can help here.
Yeah.
I can't really explain it in that, like, it was just a weird sort of, okay, not that I'm made for this, but I'm okay here. I can help this woman. I can direct things. I remember some fella coming in on some floor and letting smoke come in on the 15th floor, and he's holding the door. And I remember, what are you doing holding the door? So instead of going like, shut the fucking door, sorry, shut the damn door, I just said, I think it might be a good idea to shut the door because the smoke is coming in. Could you do that? And he just looks at me and he just came out and he shut the door. Yeah. Rather than say, you know.
Yeah, very calm, very calm.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you obviously got to the foyer and out of the building.
Yeah. Got out into the foyer, as I said. The things that bother me when I think back, not bother me, but the things that I'd rather not have seen were, because at that point I haven't really seen anything, was the damage in the foyer and the, can't put it nicely, but there's a woman basically who was taking her last breath. Fried,
you know, yeah.
Like smoke, there was smoke coming off her. And I remember there was a I don't know if they were an EMT, emergency worker, holding her. But yeah, I knew it was a woman. I knew it was a woman, and she, you know, I remember just seeing that going, oh, and then looking around and the utter destruction in the place. There was water there. I remember walking in water. And then we had to go off the concourse, and there were some other things down there as well. It was a bomb site, really, because the explosion had gone down and blown out the, and most of the foyers had been blown out because the jet fuel had come down the middle. So what we were directed towards, this is just one of those things in life. There's entrances and exits from that. It was a huge big complex. So we were directed towards the base of the, in between the two towers, there was a hotel, Marriott Hotel, that had a bar that I used to drink in. So I'm walking through the bar with another fella that I worked with. And we're kind of in a procession, in a row of people. And then we get to, and then it stops again. And now I'm looking out and I see this NYPD fella and he's screaming. And he's like, but I can't really hear him, you know. But I know, like, Jesus, what the hell is happening? So I thought at that point, because there was literally stuff dropping on the ground out on the street. I mean, from the building.
You were obviously there. We've seen the images on TV.
Yeah. So that's, he's standing there. And what he was doing was he would step out and look up. And then he would scream, okay, go, go, go. And he'd take maybe 10, 12, 15 people, whatever. And then you'd have to stop because the stuff might fall or he needed to take whatever. He just needed to be organized about it. So we're kind of like, okay, getting ready to go out. And I actually thought what was happening was fighter planes were coming in and they were like shooting on the ground. I thought, geez, this is full on war. So I was I was kind of nervous to run out. You know, I was going, well, can I just stay here? And so this other fella, Mark, that I worked with, We joked about maybe we should stop and have a quick drink. We take our place, if you like, and the cop goes, you know, and he's screaming. And the reason he screams at this point, I mean, this is happening very quickly. And it's getting louder and louder and louder. And guess what? It's the second plane.
Into the second tower.
The second plane literally hit. As Mark, the guy I was with, fell over. He doesn't know, I didn't, but when we left. He fell over and he's not sure if it was the downdraft or if it was just he tripped or something, but it had just hit above us, which is why it was, I think maybe it had hit, that's why it was so loud and that's why all this extra stuff was coming down. And anyway, this is funny, but so I ran, I don't remember, Mark went one way, I went another way, and I ran under the base of one of the walkways that went over the West Side Highway that connected the World Trade Center to the World Financial Center across the road. So there's a big, big, fat pillar. And I'm underneath the pillar, underneath the walkway. There's probably 8 or 10 people around this pillar. We're all huddled in. We're all leaning in against each other because there's all this stuff is dropping. And this huge fella, like 300-400 pounds, massive. And all he's doing, can I curse or not?
Yeah, now go ahead, yeah.
He's going, fucking Jesus, fucking motherfucker, like screaming his head off.
And the next thing he goes, oh, I'm sorry, Father, I didn't see you. One of the people is a priest. Like, how can you? And I remember thinking, the world is ending. And yeah. You're apologising to it. I mean, I thought it was lovely.
As you've just said, you thought you were under attack. And yeah. The second plane has hit, a second tower. You didn't really know what was happening. And you did know what was going to happen.
No.
Did you get away from the immediate area? I know you walked the walkway.
Yes. So for me, the end of the experience, if you like, for me, for September 11th, or the day, if you like, was when it felt like it was okay to go out, to step away from the overpass, sorry, that's what it was, that if I step out, I'm not going to get hit by anything. I did. We all, you know, it's like the rain has stopped, if you like. Mostly now was paper and stuff. So, but I'm, instead of walking, I didn't want to sprint, but I'm jogging. But I'm looking back at the buildings, and I'm trying to really figure out what's happening here. And I'm, but there was a massive adrenaline rush too. I mean, I'm a cokehead.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a massive rush to this. That I couldn't talk about that for years because I was ashamed of it, right? I mean, you can't say, oh, Jesus, it was fantastic. It's not a word you might use to describe it. But if you wanted an adrenaline rush, I mean, Jesus, you can't get much better.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of jogging down the West Side Highway down towards Lower Manhattan, Battery Park. And I swear, Pricey, maybe it's 2-3 blocks down. And I there was something in the... Can I talk about that or not?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's something in the middle of the road, and it, for want of a better description, it looked like a meat truck had hit something, and the doors had fallen out, and two big lumps of meat had fallen on the road, and it was bodies. It was two.
And this is two blocks away from the towers.
It might have even been three. I mean, I could look at it. There was I remember where I was. It was right outside another hotel, and they were. But there was no. No head, no arm, just torso. And I remember seeing it, thinking to myself as I'm sort of jogging, going, you don't need to look at that. But you can't help yourself sometimes.
Yeah,
you can't.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what that situation would be like. But when you're in it, as you said, you've got that adrenaline. You're probably in survival mode to some degree as well. You're trying to move away. Everything is, you think you're at war. You think there's a war going on where you are?
Yeah, yeah.
And you made it, obviously. I do remember, I was getting phone calls that day. I remember watching it in work, and I got phone calls from Chippy, from Tiny, I think, phoned me in work and said, you know, Kegs was in that tower. And I said, Jesus, yeah, I couldn't believe it. And I didn't know how I felt, but then word came back that night that you had made contact back with people in Ireland and that you were safe.
Yeah.
And I think somebody said you'd been on the Brooklyn Bridge looking back when the tower fell. I don't know if that's true or not.
No, it hadn't fallen yet, but it was I was just about to go over when I looked back the tower hadn't fallen, but I could see there were people jumping is what the building hadn't fallen, but there were people jumping.
It's I can only imagine I can only start to imagine how difficult that must have been. I mean, everything has gone up in the air on this day. This global situation that then developed out of that. The amount of tragedy that was involved for so many people and families.
Mm-hmm.
What you saw on that day. It dictated a bit about your future, I'd imagine, you know, moving forward for the next while.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, it's Medina, my wife, was pregnant. She was pregnant with Jack 6 months at that point. And I remember being on the bridge and about halfway over the bridge saying, I just need to get home to her. It was a Tuesday. The apartment we had, because I lived on the other side of the bridge, actually had a view of both the towers. I think you know that, right? So she could never remember which one I was in because it was weird from perspective. You can't tell which one is which. So... And I, you know, like a bit of a thrill in, you know, just generally in life. I've always enjoyed that. And her fear was that I might hang around, even though the buildings were still up. So I didn't want her to think that, obviously, so I made my way home. And I remember getting home, she had just voted. It was a voting day over here, and someone had told her one of the towers was on fire. So when she went home, she actually saw the second plane hit. So she was, and she's, you know, born and reared in New York City. So for her, it was, you know, and her husband's in there. So anyway, I got home, and I'll never forget the embrace, because she's, you know, 6 months pregnant.
Sure, yeah.
And
yeah.
And then just the feeling of, and I brought three or four other people home, or told them where to come to. I had run on ahead. So we had about probably half an hour, just she and I, before these other lads arrived that I had worked with, that I told to come because I live very close by. And at some point, I don't remember what point, but very quickly we heard a noise, and then you just couldn't see. Just
smoke.
The smoke didn't actually come over by us yet, but we just couldn't see. Just all of a sudden, this massive smoke. And so we're now aware that obviously both buildings, or the first one had come down, and then shortly after that, the second one came down.
Wow.
Yeah. I think it was by 10:30. So very quickly.
By 10:30, yeah. But that's for a lot of people, that would be very, very difficult. Very difficult. You know, you've been in the building, you've been out, and did you lose anybody close to you that day? Was there anybody?
I did. I lost, not very close. No one very close, but I lost probably 5 or 6 people I had worked with at various points. There were a few unknowns, funnily enough, but people that used to start work very early. I was starting work at 5:30 or 6 in the morning. So, and taking the train at that hour and people getting off of this, you know the way you say.
Yeah, you get to morning. Know people. Yeah.
Yeah. I never saw those people again. I don't know, you know, doesn't mean that they died, but I think it was 5 or 6 people that I knew directly. No one in my company died, thankfully. Oh, sorry, one person did, who had been attending a conference in Windows on the World, which was the restaurant on the top of the North Tower.
Yeah.
But other than that, no one else from my job, my office.
Okay. Well, look, I don't want to exhaust that talking about the Twin Towers, because, you know, it's that was obviously a very traumatic day, and maybe for years to come you didn't feel that trauma. You know, it may, as you said, you enjoyed the adrenaline to a certain degree of various things. When did it actually kick in? What happened?
I mean, it kicked in straight away. You know, it can't not kick in, but it's not in the sense of like, I went back down there, I think, very next day, and took tons of photographs. And I thought to myself, like, oh, yeah, this is what you read about when people get, like, PTSD and they don't ever go back to the same spot. So I remember saying, well, I'll go back tomorrow. I'll just go down and immerse myself in it, so I'm not, like, trying to escape it or something. And there's no right or wrong way, but, I mean, at that point, probably, I was already mad into booze and drugs. I had been since I was 8, you know, young.
Yeah.
So it made sense to me. I found that with the booze made me maudlin. You know, I'd get emotional. I'd get, you know, if someone said to me, you know, can you talk about it or whatever, I didn't have a problem talking about it. It wasn't like that. It was just like, I didn't really, not if I'm drunk, not if I've had a few on me, because then I'm going to get emotional. I might cry, or I might, you know, but I didn't find that with cocaine. I just didn't. It made it very practical to me. It made perfect sense.
Did your coke habit, was that something that stayed the same after as before, or was that, did it increase? It
got really bad.
Did it?
Yeah, it really did. And it got, not immediately, but, you know, because Jack was born 3 months later, so I just couldn't keep it together, to be honest. It wasn't like life was out of control. It was out of control, but not, you couldn't see it. It's just, you know, I was still able to show up for work. I was good at what I did, so I made a lot of money for the company I worked for. So they were, and plus everyone had just gone through what we'd gone through. So there was kind of like, you know, a little leniency shown to people who might show up late or hungover.
But I made the most of that. The truth is, I used that as well. I don't want to say used it, but it was good cover. Jesus, you look in the general direction of Lower Manhattan and you get off scot-free. So I did, but for the next 2 years, you know, the first 2 years of Jack's life, I was off the rails, completely and utterly off the rails.
Yeah.
You know, I was that idiot in Wolf of Wall Street, but it was my own show. There was no one with me. I'd go into hotel rooms for days, 2 or 3 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I went full on, and I would, you know, people would come over, you know, the wrong people would come over. I got involved with the wrong, well, if you're buying drugs, you're always hanging around with the wrong people. And I would, 2 or 3 days was not unusual, not every week or every month, maybe every month, I would disappear. And I would
that had to have an effect on your marriage.
It destroyed the marriage. I mean, it absolutely destroyed the marriage. I remember thinking that I'm going to be the F up that my old man was, that I'm an alcoholic, I'm probably a drug addict now. I can't be the father I want to be. I can't be the husband I want to be. I really didn't want that. I never thought about topping myself. I really didn't. But I just couldn't see a way out. I can't stop. I have no idea how to stop. Mad coke habit.
I know you're going through the coke and the drink and the marriage has fallen apart. And as you've described as a mad coke habit, when did the point come when you just said enough is enough? Or did somebody grab you by the scruff of the neck and say enough is enough, let's go see somebody?
So I think it was the summer of 2003. I'd had physical problems. I remember my insides were really messed up from booze as well, I was all dry or something. I had to have mad surgery. Like, oh, jeez, it was horrible. I knew, like, physically I was deteriorating. I knew that. Mentally if it looked okay on the outside, I could tell myself it was okay. So I still had a paycheck coming in. We still functioned relatively okay in the marriage. I had Jack. The one place, Brycey, the one place that I found any peace, and I'm not saying that out of self-pity, it's just the truth, was on the floor in his room when he was an infant. You remember this when you were three. When kids are infants, they breathe like, they sort of suck in the air, and I would just listen to that, and I'd lie on the rug on his floor. I didn't know how to cry. I didn't know how to talk, like, about emotional stuff or about what I felt. I just didn't know how to do anything. And I was at that point 30, whatever, 5, 6 years of age. But all I really want, like I said, didn't want to kill myself or anything. But the one reason to keep me sane was Jack.
Was Jack,
little
yeah.
kid.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me emotional thinking about it. But at a point where I remember going home one night, yet again, and high as a kite, a huge amount of drugs that I was doing. And I went into the house, and Medina had been asleep maybe 4 or 5 in the morning. And I broke down next to the bed next to her, and I was crying, and I'm telling her how bad it was. She didn't know how bad that. She didn't actually know I had a coke habit.
Wow.
Yeah. But I remember then her saying, like, getting out of bed and sort of grabbing me and going, it'll be okay, it'll be okay. But I remember thinking, but I've got 3 or 4 more grams on me. I mean, I need to. Can I come back to you?
I'll
come back to you in an hour. And I remember, I didn't start a fight, but I remember a fight happened. Now she knew, the cat's out of the bag kind of thing. She got involved in calling rehabs, in calling my boss, because I was having problems at work. They were allowing me, you know, because I was making money, they weren't looking the other way. They just didn't know what to do either. And eventually, I relapsed. So I was trying to stop myself, but I relapsed a few times over the summer. It got really bad. And then she said to me, I don't remember exactly, but it was like, you know, either you stop or you're going to, you'll never see your son again, along those lines. You won't see me. We're getting a divorce if you don't stop. And I couldn't bear that thought. I couldn't bear the thought of not seeing Jack the way I wanted to see him. I wasn't sure. The marriage wasn't great, obviously.
Yeah.
I wasn't. She was great. I wasn't.
Yeah.
So then I went off to rehab in August of 2003. Actually, the day is the 14th of August. It was the day it was a massive blackout. The electrical grid went down on the whole northeast coast. You obviously fucked the system up when you were over.
Yeah, I did.
It was that day. The whole of the east coast or the northeast went down off the power grid. But my bloody plane got out, and I ended up in Minnesota in a rehab.
In a full-on rehab. So is this like, you'd say, American Dream. Two weeks, 4 weeks, that type of thing, in-house?
It was 4 weeks. So I have to tell you this because it's actually a funny story. So the first night I arrived there, or when I arrived there, some alpha that picked me up in the airport, and he was driving what they called the druggy buggy, or the alcoholer. That was the other nickname given to the van that drives you to the rehab. So we get to the rehab, and there's a load of people around the TV, and they're looking at the TV, and I go over, and I'm literally checking in, right, into the rehab. And I look over, and I see thousands of people going over the Brooklyn Bridge. It's New York again, and I'm going, Jesus Christ, there's about to be an attack. I flipped out.
Yeah.
I'm screaming and shouting at the alpha, like, drive me back to Minneapolis Airport. And he looked at me, and he said, there's nothing. There's no planes. The whole grid is gone. It's down. You can't go anywhere. And fuck you. Fuck that. Horrible. So they say, you have to, the first night in the place, you have to go onto a medical, you're on watch, medical watch. I don't know if you've ever had a panic attack, have you?
Nothing serious.
I didn't know what a panic attack was. I'd heard people talk about, pussies had panic attacks, right? You know, or whatever. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
Sorry, but like weaklings had panic attacks, and I'm no weakling, right? I'm not having a panic. I'm on this medical unit, the middle of the night. I can't go back to. I did speak to Medina, so I'm lying there. There's only me and one other fella on the unit, and he was like, from the booze, he was shaking nonstop. But we'd had a few cigarettes together. So anyway, middle of the night, I'm fast asleep. The next thing I know is I'm having what I think is a heart or a stroke, tingling down here, not mad, like pain, but like I can't breathe. I've got tingling in the back of my neck. I feel like I'm having a stroke, even though I've never had a stroke, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know the way when you're in a dream and you're trying to get out of the dream, but you can't? So I'm like, and eventually something came out, which must have scared him, because the next thing I know, he's by my bed. You all right? I'm okay. Let me call a nurse. And I remember shouting, don't fucking call a nurse, because I thought they were going to come in like one flew out of the cuckoo's.
Injection, strap you up.
That's it. Lobotomy, I'm done. So I says, no. So I tried to go back to sleep, and then the same thing happened. So I didn't know what they were, but it turns out they were panic attacks. So the next morning, I told you, man, not to call anybody. Why would you get help when you're sick?
Particularly when you're paying for it.
Shut up and go to sleep. So thankfully, the next morning, you have to get checked out by the doctor. The doctor was from Brooklyn. He was from Bay Ridge in Brooklyn, as Irish as they come. You know, he's from Brooklyn, but he's Irish. So he says to me, all your tests are okay, you know, you're blah, 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 anything you need to tell me? And I went, no, but I think I might have had a mini stroke last night. So he goes, okay, well, what happened? So I said to him, what happened? And he goes, that, my friend, was a panic attack. Pricey, I looked at him and went, oh, yeah, no, I'm Irish.
We don't get panic attacks.
And he's probably still laughing. Yeah, all right, okay. That was a panic attack. Yeah. So
Well, look, I have to This is a usual thing that happens when I get to chat to you. We were going to have a
Jesus
chat.
Jesus Christ, we're talking for 2 hours.
2 hours. So I'm going to have to split this. Anybody listening to this podcast now is probably listening to part three right. at this stage. So we're going to have...
They're now doing drugs.
This has been cut into we're only up to 2000 and whatever. But yeah. So if I can just bring it forward a bit on a keg, yeah. you're in rehab.
Yeah.
The rehab is the start of the journey
yeah.
to come off the cocaine habit, the booze... The gambling, all those elements of your life that you'd call addiction.
Yeah.
Oh so
yeah.
That was the start of it. And if we sort of jump forward a bit from the rehab, when you got out of rehab and came back to New York, did you stay clean? Did you stay dry?
For 4 months I did. I relapsed after 4 months. The relapse nearly killed me, actually. I remember... Part of my body froze, my chest froze. I remember thinking that I was in a hotel, boarded up, like, you know, closed the curtains and everything. And I remember thinking that this could be it. Like, I may not.
Yeah.
I genuinely thought. And the scary.
Was this a relapse on drugs or drugs or drugs? Yeah.
Straight to the cocaine.
Yeah.
And I remember, which is why why I was having this seizure of some sort. And the scariest thing that I can remember was that I went straight back to it. I mean, it was in the room. I just continued.
Yeah.
And since that day, I've been clean. So I'm coming up on 17 years clean.
17 years.
Yeah.
Well, that deserves a round of applause.
A boule of boss.
Yeah, a boule of boss. Yeah. That deserves that. 17 years. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously those 17 years, a lot has happened. Your son Jack, 17 years. You spoke about him when you went to rehab. He was a young lad. He's probably 18 now, is he? 17, 18? 18 now.
He'll be 19 in a couple of, in December.
And that relationship that you worried about when he was a young lad, that's strong and... good bond there.
He's living well. I got divorced in 2005. The marriage just couldn't. So getting clean, to anybody who's listening, getting clean is not about. The very first step is the only way I can describe to you, Pricey, is I remember hearing a guy talking about this, and he held up a piece of kitchen paper. And he tore off a little corner of it and he said, that is alcohol. We were talking about alcoholism at that point. That is alcohol. And then he held up the rest of the thing and he goes, this is alcoholism. And what he meant by that was, this is the thought process. All of what made you drink in the first place, all of the stuff that's missing in your life, that's, if you don't take care of this huge big piece and you think that the only thing you need to do is not drink, or use drugs or involve yourself in the chaos, you will drink again or you'll be miserable for the rest of your life. I didn't fully understand what he meant, but I get it now. So this is actually, I really do mean this because this is the one thing I do talk about. I've been up to Rikers a whole bunch of times. You know Rikers Island in New York, terrible prison. I go in and I talk to people in prisons, talk to people in hospitals. I speak frequently enough about addiction. And it's far beyond just, there's so much more that goes on, that, like the drinking the drugs is just the tip of the iceberg. So there's a process of me not drinking for 2 years and then the marriage fell apart. If I say that to 10 people who are alcoholic and who they'll know exactly what it is, what I'm talking about. I had no ability to feel. I couldn't relate to thoughts. My wife would cry. She'd describe things to me and I couldn't cry. I just couldn't relate to anything.
How's your relationship now, 17 years on from?
It's okay. It's business. It's business like.
Yeah.
She's remarried. Yeah. She remarried. I'm not sure, maybe seven years ago. For a long time, it was not. You know, we have a son together. We never didn't go to all of his events together. We always sat together. We always put all of that stuff aside. I would like to be more friendly with her, I suppose, more friendly. We're friendly enough.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're not friends.
we're very respectful, and we've raised a son together. And my hat's off to her for that, because I wasn't an easy person to deal with. I mean that with all my heart. Like, I'm not saying she was a walk in the park either. It's just the dynamic didn't work. But we raised a kid together.
Yeah.
And he's now living with me, which is...
That's great. Congratulations. Oh, look, your story is showing strength and character. I introduced you to being this, and I said there's been challenges in your life. You know, we started talking about teenage years in Dublin and London and going to Australia and stuff like that. But I suppose the addiction and the gambling and then the big thing, the drugs and drink, really became heavy in the States. And it was a challenge for you to deal with this. And you have. And you've gone 360, as I said, as well. Because another thing that's happened is in your 50s, you went back to college.
Yeah.
You went back to study.
Yeah, and, thanks for saying going back to college, because I did do a week.
You did spend a week, yeah. But what are you actually studying? What are you studying? Let us know.
I got a degree in economics and business management. I just finished it in earlier this year, and I am going to blow my own trumpet here, Pricey. Because
that's okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I got a four in America. A 4.0 is basically the highest grade you can possibly get for a 4-year degree. I got a 4.0, which means A's and everything. I won a state award.
That must be that OCD coming in when you were studying as well. Yeah.
It is. It was like, and it's this.
Tell us, you got a state award.
So I won this what's called the Chancellor's Award for academic excellence. Me.
Wow! Wow! Well done.
That was in I think I was told in the end of February that I was going to get that award, that I'd won the award for the state, for the school. Four people in my school were awarded it out of, I think, 13,000 in the people who graduated this year.
Yeah.
But here's the bet that, and this is just because, like you, Pricey, I'm a determined person, always have been. But I started in, and I don't know if I told you this or not, but I got accepted to Harvard in March.
Wow.
The same, like a month after I got the state, sometime around then anyway. I'm doing a master's at Harvard now.
And you're doing an online blended at Harvard's.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's a two-year. Two-year, 12 month or 24 month?
Well, no, it's minimum 24. To spend maybe, obviously we're in a pandemic, so... The plan was, it's roughly 40% on campus and 60% online.
Well, I think that deserves a final round of applause on that there. Big boule of us there. That's brilliant. Well, look, we could talk for hours. There's no question about it.
It's great to see you. And it's
great to see you, but not just that. There's a lot of people that hopefully will be listening to this podcast. Yeah, I'm going to have to, after listening to the end of it now, and it will have been divided into, so if you're on to part 3 or 4 now, go back and listen to part 1 and 2 to the story, because we'll have to split this one up, because it's a fantastic story. There's loads more we can talk about. And what I might do on this one, Kegs, is have you back on the podcast. We might actually take, you know, this topic a little bit further about, you know, where you are now and where you're going.
I would love to. If you will have me back, I would love to, because I think what we talked about is, yes, okay, there are facts and details of my life, which is great, great. The important part for me is that if I'm given an opportunity to help someone who's been in a similar position, and I guarantee you, and you know this as well as I do, with addiction and how it works, the people who are going to listen to this are going to be in a place or know someone who's in a place where they feel they cannot get out. They cannot get out. There's a way out. I spend my time not because I'm a saint or anything, because it helps me stay recovered, in recovery, helping other people. And I mean that. Like, if someone hears that and they need to get a hold of me, I'll give you...
Yeah, that's really important. That's anybody can contact us here. There are details for this podcast. So if anybody out there listens to this, as Brian said, as Keg said there, knows somebody or is in a situation and needs to reach out, certainly get in touch with us through the number, and we can put you in touch with Brian. There's no problem there at all.
Yeah.
Brian Kerrigan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We could keep going. I'm going to have you back on the podcast. This is first time you've been on Pricey's Talk.
Yeah.
So we'll keep
fantastic.
It going. I wish you the very best in New
Thanks,
York.
Pricey.
And we'll all stop the record buttons now. Wow. That was some story from Brian from Kegs. I really do hope you enjoyed that. It was a pleasure to have Brian Kerrigan on the podcast today, and I know that we're going to have him back because there's an awful lot more to his story. What he didn't mention also is that he's going to put pen to paper and write a book about his life story. I'm not sure of what the title is yet, and we will come back to you and we will let you know and we will talk to Brian about this. Thank you for listening to our story today, Natural Born Addict Surviving 9/11 with Brian Kerrigan.